Hello, you. You're listening to the first edition of Cromford's Assortment, my attempt at an online magazine programme. I've no idea how this series will develop, because this is a completely new field for me. But in the current emergency, we're going to need to find all sorts of ways to entertain ourselves and each other. So, this is me making a start. I'd like to present stuff that I think might amuse you or entertain you, and there's no grand plan apart from that. So, you're welcome to come along with me, and let's just follow our noses. This, by the way, is some of my music for talking over. You'll half hear this and a few other pieces in future programmes, while I do continuity links and waffle breezily over the top of them, just like this. So anyway, what's today? Today is the 26th of March. On this day in 1979, Anwar Sadat of Egypt and Menachem Begin of Israel signed the Egypt-Israel Peace Treaty on the White House lawn, witnessed by President Jimmy Carter. On this day in 1971, Bangladesh declared independence from Pakistan. This one. On this day in 2015, King Richard III's remains were reburied in Leicester Cathedral after they had been discovered underneath a council employee's car park in the city of Leicester. I just love that. It's not all good news. On this day in 1982, Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder released Ebony and Ivory. And on this day in 1953, Jonas Salk announced his vaccine to combat polio. I'm reading from the On This Day website here. He was uninterested in personal profit, and when asked in a televised interview who owned the patent to the vaccine, Salk replied, "There is no patent. Could you patent the sun?" Isn't that marvellous? It'd be great if the drugs companies and the pharmaceuticals companies of today could be like that about something like, oh, I don't know, COVID-19? On this day in 1842, Italian general Giuseppe Garibaldi married Anna Maria de Jesus Ribeiro. And if that doesn't take the biscuit, I don't know what does. On this day in 1960, actor Yul Brynner divorced his wife. That's the same year he starred in The Magnificent Seven, playing that lean, mean, Cajun-type gunslinger bloke. Whew, you didn't mess with him, did you? And finally, March the 26th apparently is National Spinach Day in the USA. So guess what foodstuff is flying off the supermarket shelves over there at the moment? None of which has anything to do with the next item, which is just a bit of warts and all fun. It's a novelty song written by Dwight Latham and Mo Joffe in 1947. And here's a slightly Americanized version of me busking it in my bedroom studio last Monday. Now this here is a very sad story. Now many, many years ago, when I was 23, I was married to a widow who was pretty as can be. This widow had a grown-up daughter who had hair of red. My father fell in love with her, and soon they two were wed. This made my dad my son-in-law and changed my very life. My daughter was my mother, for she was my father's wife. To complicate the matter, even though it brought me joy, I soon became the father of a bouncing baby boy. My little baby then became a brother-in-law to Dad, and so became my uncle, though it made me very sad. For if he was my uncle, then that also made him brother of the widow's grown-up daughter, who, of course, was my stepmother. Father's wife then had a son who kept them on the run, and he became my grandchild, for he was my daughter's son. My wife is now my mother's mother, and it makes me blue, because although she is my wife, she's my grandmother too. Now if my wife is my grandmother, then I'm her grandchild. Oh, and every time I think of it, it nearly drives me wild. For now I have become the strangest case you ever saw. As husband of my grandmother, I am my own grandpa. Sounds funny, I know, but it really is so. Oh, I'm my own grandpa. I'm my own grandpa. I'm my own grandpa. It sounds funny, I know, but it really is so. Oh, I'm my It certainly does. That accent was atrocious. And now I'd like to read to you. Actually, you might want to save this bit until late tonight, because it's sort of like a book at bedtime, but I'm going to be reading a ghost story, so I call this spot a boo at bedtime. without any further ado, if you're lounging comfortably, I'll begin. A Vindictive Woman by R. Chetwynd Hayes. Part 1. Robert C. Hogg was a sparse, shy little man who ambled through life with lowered head and cautious steps, as though harbouring grave suspicions about the suburban paving stones. He lived at the very top of the house, in a miserable two-roomed flat with sagging ceilings, shrunken window frames, and walls that had long ago shed their cheap wallpaper. It was difficult to define his age, but he must have been at least 65, as I once saw him in the post office drawing his state pension. Nevertheless, his receding, mouse-coloured hair was only just flecked with silver. His pale, narrow face, save for two deep furrows on either side of the thin-lipped mouth, was unlined, and his small grey eyes were bright with undiminished intelligence. Nothing other than the bowed shoulders and slow walk suggested that a growing burden of years was gradually taking its toll. The only mail addressed to him that I ever saw on the hall table was the familiar buff envelope from the football pools, which at least testified that he was not lacking a certain element of optimism. He went for a walk every morning, mainly a slow stroll around the town, which generally terminated in one of the many pubs, where he sat, nursing a half-pint glass of brown ale. The rest of his time appeared to be spent in that top-floor flat, doing I knew not what. It might be as well if I were to stress that, although the house was subdivided into seven, for want of a better term, living units, in fact, Robert C. Hogg and I appeared to be the only people living there. Five other unknown and rarely seen tenants either rented a room as an accommodation address or used it to spend the odd night whenever business brought them into the area. I, needing space that could be used as a place of work and residence, rented the entire basement and, a completely unwarranted piece of extravagance, the massive back garden as well. I worked in the back and front rooms alternately, being of the opinion that a change of scene helps to keep the creative stream flowing, and thus did not always see Robert C. Hogg mount the front steps. But sometimes, when the night was overcast and I had yet to close my curtains, I knew he was in his flat, for a rectangular slab of yellowish light lay across the lawn, an almost perfect facsimile of a lighted window, complete with four black-edged squares that bordered each pane, plus a bowed shadow figure that kept passing back and forth across this illuminated frame. I often thought how disconcerting it would be for a permanent occupant in the room below to hear this continuous pacing, and I wondered what troubled line of thought prompted the little man to do it. Perhaps he was beset by some problem which required such deep concentration that it could only be maintained by constant movement. Whatever the reason, I soon became a little disturbed by the spectacle, and took to closing my curtains whenever the block of light flashed into being. One night in early January, when the moon illuminated the 30 or so feet of lawn, transforming the slightly frosted grass into a gleaming silver carpet and obliterating every shadow, save for the dense cluster that lurked under two old elm trees at the far end, I walked two-thirds of the way up the garden and then turned and cast a cursory glance at the uppermost windows. Why I took the trouble to come out on such a cold night, I can't think. Idle curiosity, I suspect, prompted by an urge to see if my neighbour still paced in front of his window, even when conditions did not allow his silhouette to be projected onto the lawn. On this night, his lights were out, But even so, I detected the faint outline of a figure that might have been standing some little way back from the curtainless window, staring down, either at me or at the two trees that were some way to my rear. Embarrassed by being caught out in an act of blatant nosiness, I swung round and pretended to examine the trees myself. I soon came to the conclusion that they were scarcely worthy of attention. Bleak and naked against the cold, steel-grey sky, their skeletal branches creaked forlornly when disturbed by the gentle easterly wind. Then I lowered my eyes and became uncomfortably aware of the dense block of shadow that seemed to be an extension of the sturdy trunks, a thick splodge of darkness that, if viewed in a certain way, took on the form of a black-clad figure. I quickly switched my gaze back to Hogg's windows, but now they were gleaming mirrors that reflected the bright moonlight, and there was no way of deciding if an unseen spectator still lurked behind the shining facade. My tiny stock of courage was seeping away when I again faced the two trees and dared to ask a simple question.
Is there anyone there?
An answer would have been a precious gift from whatever saint watches over frightened men, while the ensuing silence was surely more terrifying even than the shriek of a doomed soul riding in on the wind. With my head turned to the far right, my left eye had an oblique view of the furthermost tree, and it seemed as though I could see a dark shape that might have been that of a woman dressed in black and wearing a long head shawl. An inch either side and the vision was lost, becoming merely a slab of shadow that merged into the tree trunk. Without further words or thought, I ran to warmth and transient security, without looking up or back. I locked doors and closed curtains in an endeavour to prove that anything which could not be seen did not exist. Robert C. Hogg made his first tenuous approach the following evening. There came a timid tap on my hall door, which, when opened, revealed the bent-shouldered little figure standing on the bottom stair. Without raising his head, he said quietly,
"My lights have gone out."
His voice was unexpectedly cultured, in some inexplicable way adding to the air of oddness that was manifest in every line of his body. I said, "I expect your fuse has blown. Have you examined it?"
"I know very little about such things. Where exactly will I find the fuse?"
"Would you like me to look at it for you?" I asked.
"If you would be so kind."
I collected fuse wire, a pair of pliers, a screwdriver, and, as an afterthought, an electric torch, and followed him up three flights of stairs. A strip light on the top landing enabled me to see the open door of his flat and part of the tiny kitchen beyond. But I was completely unprepared for the unpleasant smell that seemed to be waiting to pounce the moment I set foot over the threshold. It had a sweetish, cloying quality that can only be associated with a rotting corpse. And it was so intense that I only just managed to suppress a snort of disgust. You can hear part two of A Vindictive Woman in next week's programme. And that's all we have time for this week. I hope you've enjoyed this mishmash of stuff, and if so, please make a date for the next edition of Cromford's Assortment, on Thursday the 2nd of April. In the meantime, keep a grip on yourself. Be patient. Stay sane, safe, and well. I made this program for you, and I'm going to be here sending them out for as long as you're there to receive them. The world is full of bods like me, exploring new ways to entertain in the current situation. And we will come through this. We will. Bye for now. Cromford's assortment was conceived and put together by Paul Cromford. I'm My Own Grandpa was written by Dwight Latham and Mo Joffe. Performed by Paul Cromford. A Vindictive Woman was written by R. Chetwynd Hayes. Read by Paul Cromford. Spooky ambient music during the reading of A Boo at Bedtime, courtesy of ESN Productions, Carol Mordant Todd, and
Paul Cromford.
All other incidental music, title music, etc., etc., by
Paul Cromford.
This was a Paul Cromford production for, well, you, really.